Oh, okay, so let's, then we can work.
Open. We are going to carry over a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 571 and 611. And we will postpone and carry over Senate Bill 59. So our official business is pushed off on at least official business in terms of legislation. And I will open up an informational hearing, getting back to what was once the beginning of this session a few weeks ago. And look at school funding. We have a team up here from the department and Jay. So welcome.
It doesn't look like it's from the department.
Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, if I could
point
out something for the committee. Before we go into the kind of the nuts and bolts around education and some discussion of the task force from the interim, the revenue forecast tomorrow, you'll get your traditional quarterly forecast. You'll be joined by the House, is invited to attend. But it's also in our March forecast, we will give you an annual update on our estimated local revenue for the school distribution formula. And of course, that's primarily property tax. And since we have updated data on the property tax from the November collections, Day has been working on an update for you, and that will be the key number that goes into the for the co-chair's budget.
And Dr. Warner, just for clarification for the public, the revenue forecast is at 8 tomorrow, 8:30?
Senator, it's at 8:30.
Okay. In this hearing room?
Yes.
Okay. It's very hearing room. Yes. All right. One of the more, I guess everything is complex in our tax code, but one of the more Byzantine systems of distributing money and keeping it in order is our school funding revenue allocation. So, gentlemen, thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. So here with me, Mr. Brian Weeder, Assistant Superintendent of Oregon Education Department. So what I want to do is I want to give you a big picture about this formula revenue or distribution of it, and then punt the difficult details to Brian Reeder. So some background information. The revenue available is the sum of state school fund that the legislature appropriates every biennium, and local revenues of school districts and education service districts. After carve-outs from the top and set asides, school districts receive 95.5% of the total revenue, and education service districts gets 4.5%. Within SD and ESD shares, there are statutorily defined grants and distributions. So when there is a set budget and changes in the amount to be distributed to school districts and education service districts, we get to this distribution chart. And if you can just click on the link. But it is from a year ago. So when budget is set and when there is change in distribution of money, or the available money for distribution, we are going to make this chart and distribute to the members and the public. So then, first big picture. As I said, state school fund plus local revenue becomes total dollars available for school districts and ESDs. And you gotta subtract some carve-outs and set aside from the top. Small high school grants, talented and gifted program, speech pathology, virtual school district, and NQTL, quality teaching network, and long-term care and treatment, Oregon School for the Deaf, pediatric nursing facility, and some reserves and others. some of them are specified, the numbers are specified in ORS, some are set aside because ODE is responsible for education of certain programs. Now, from total dollars available, you subtract these carve-outs and set asides, it becomes formula revenue to be distributed. By the way, the reserves actually will be eventually distributed back to SDES and ESDs. So from formula revenue to be distributed, again, school share, school district share is 95.5%. And out of that, you got to subtract high-cost disabilities grant. At this point, it's $18 million a year. Facility grant and school district share of NQTL. Last biennium, it was $14 million.
NQTL
is Quality Teaching Network. Actually, so last biennium, about $35 million was allocated. $5 million off the top, and $14 million each from school districts and ESDs. Respectively, the Quality Teaching Network, or the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, it is officially called, is to support the better education so that the teachers and the schools can be better prepared for teaching kids.
So you've got $7 billion budgeted for K-12. Schools get 95.5% of that. Then you subtract the high cost facility grants and the quality teaching learning. And what's left is what gets distributed to 198.
Gets distributed based on formula. And basically, ADMW comes into play, and teaching teachers' experience comes into play. And the total available amount of money comes into play. And out of that, out of total formula revenue, ESD share is 4.5%. And when subtract 10th grade assessment, it's about $1 million a year. and ESD share of Quality Teaching Network is, again, the same amount as school districts. It's about last biennium it was $14 million. Would be escalated to higher level when the legislature decides to appropriate more money in state school fund. So this formula revenue available for distribution to ESDs will be distributed based on component school districts ADMW. To recap, state school fund plus local revenue becomes total revenue available, and subtract carve-outs and set-asides becomes total formula revenue for distribution. School districts gets 95.5, ESD gets 4.5. Again, from school districts, you have subtractions in the form of high-cost disabilities grant, facility grant, and Quality Teaching Network, and based on ADMW, money will be distributed to school districts and ESDs. Subtract 10th grade assessment, ESD share of NQTL becomes formula revenue available to be distributed to ESDs based on component school districts ADMW, and there's a minimum of $1 million for education service district. So then, Brian. So I'm done for my part, actually, and I'm going to ask Mr. Reeder to explain the details of how ADMW is determined and how much is allocated for high-cost disability grant and facility grant and other things.
For the record, Brian Reeder, Oregon Department of Education. I'm going to move through these fairly quickly since Day gave a good overview. So if you have questions, go ahead and interrupt me. If you see something that you need some clarification on, otherwise I'll move through it at a good clip. Really want to touch on four things. Where's the funding come from? How much is it? How does it get to school districts and ESDs? And what are the key cost drivers in education in Oregon? Here's a history of school district operating revenue. This is all operating revenue, not just what they get through the formula. So it also includes federal grants and state grants are the big difference. Also, some school districts have local option property taxes that are in here but don't go through the revenue. What you can see is the rather dramatic decline in local revenue. That's Measure 5, the initial Measure 5, starting in 1990-91. Slight blip up in 95-96, or 96-97, I guess, when Measure 5 was fully phased in. You'll recall that the tax rates for education phased down in Measure 5 over 5 years, and then blips back down with the passage of Measures 47 and 50 in 1997. And then under the provisions of Measure 50, which allow 3% growth in the assessed value of individual properties, the growth in local revenue has been quite steady since the mid-90s. You'll see that federal revenue has been fairly steady also, and the blip up in the later years is the added stimulus money that states got from the federal government in the recession. And you'll also see that state revenue has been quite volatile. Here's the distribution of the sources in 12-13. 12-13 is the latest year we have actual audited data from school districts. So these are actual numbers. These are not budget numbers. 53% from the state, 10% from federal government, and 37% from local sources. The breakdown between state and local today is about reversed of it from what it was back before the passage of Measure 5. It was about two-thirds local and one-third state. Here's a breakdown of the federal sources, predominantly grants from the federal government that come to the Department of Education and then are passed through to school districts based on federal law. A small amount of federal grants that go directly to school districts, and then federal forest fees, which are, again, in limbo. It's a bit distorted up there, isn't it?
Brian?
Yes.
Question to that slide previous.
So on the pass-through money from the federal, how much of that is earmarked or it has to go to a specific function? How much of that is?
Chair Haas, Senator Bertschinger, pretty much all of it. There's virtually no discretion over federal grant money. Federal funds at all.
Special needs or solar power. Or whatever.
Correct.
Is this like Title III monies or anything?
Exactly. Title I, Title III are the large programs, federal programs. Federal forest fees generally flow into district general funds, so they're the exception. But the grant money are for very specific purposes.
Brian, can you talk just – this is sort of revitalizing these old – memories on the federal forest fees. What exactly are we talking there? And are those all figured? Can you remind me how that works with the whole equalization pot?
Yes, Chair Haas. Federal forest fees, they travel a long road to get to where they stop. They come to counties, and counties then share them with school districts. They share a portion with school districts, and they keep a portion for themselves. When they get to school districts count those as part of their local revenue in our formula. So those, in essence, offset state funds that the district would have gotten state school fund revenue through the formula. So as federal forest fees have declined over the years, those districts who received them are in essence made whole with increased state funding through the formula, because the formula balances, in essence, it looks at both local and state money and says each district gets roughly the same amount per student of local and state money combined. And we'll get, I've got a couple slides that, show that a little more clearly when we get there.
Okay, thanks.
Local shares are dominated, of course, by local property taxes. School districts also have fees and charges. A big chunk of those are school lunch revenue and athletic fees. They also get a relatively small amount of revenue from other local governments. Sometimes cities will simply give money to school districts because they feel that's a more important use of their money than what they might have used it for by the city itself. Not a lot of that going on in Oregon, but some of it. And then private donations, things from foundations and so forth. The state share, state school fund is over 90% of the total. There are some state grants, increasingly under the strategic initiative programs. State grants have been growing some. State managed timber, and then the common school fund. The common school fund is a fund that is primarily money from state lands department, from state timber harvests. So, a little background on the formula adopted by the 1991 legislature. It first took effect in 92-93 school year. It had some what at the time were called stop-loss features that prevented high-funded school districts from having large reductions in their school funding. So it sort of phased in over time to hold higher-funded districts somewhat harmless as the formula brought up the low-funded districts. The formula hasn't really changed much over this period. It distributes most of the money, about 95% of it, on a weighted student basis. There's some other pieces, the carve-outs that Dave talked about and the transportation funding that are not based on weighted students. And the goal of the formula is to distribute funds equitably, compensating districts for differences in the costs that they have that are outside the district's control. ODE calculates the formula amounts for each district in ESD, and at this point, when we say formula, we mean both state and local money. And then we distribute that money to districts in ESDs. We distribute the state school fund, or the state portion of it, to bring them up to the amount that the formula guarantees them. So, for example, if a district is entitled to $20 million from the formula and they've raised $5 million locally, then they'll get $15 million in state money. If they're entitled to $20 million and they've raised $12 million locally, then they'll get $8 million in state money. So it's that formula amount that is what they get, a combination of both local and state money.
So if Lake Oswego or Beaverton raises a lot in property taxes, they're per pupil spending in Lake Oswego and Curry County will be pretty much the same.
That's correct. Their per pupil revenue through the formula will be roughly the same. Lake Oswego is an example where they have a local option property tax, so they raise some more money locally, so their spending is actually a bit higher. But in terms of the formula itself, it's pretty much the same per student throughout the state.
Senator Burchard.
So in the rural communities, if they, or it has been in the, well, not in the 90s, but before that, where they see more revenue coming from natural resources, then it would be the reverse then, that they would receive less money from the state.
Chair Haas, Senator Bertschinger, that's right. If they, for whatever reason, generate more local revenue, For example, a mill moves in, or a manufacturing plant moves in, or a gas terminal moves in, generating more local revenue, then their state money would be reduced.
Well,
but they would still get the amount.
I'm talking more about federal revenue coming from, like we used to get with our ONC monies and stuff. We literally built 3 high schools and did a whole bunch of other things with that money. Would that also count?
I believe so. I don't know about the ONC money specifically, but if we talk about a similar situation with federal forest fees, as those decline, state revenue goes up to make those districts whole.
So if those came back, then state revenue would go down?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So earlier I showed a graph that showed total operating revenue. About 80% of that comes through the formula, and the remaining 20% is federal grants, state grants, fees and charges, and if a district passes a local option property tax, that would be in that 20% as well. As I mentioned, the formula distributes a small amount of federal revenue, the federal forest fees. In essence, those become, for formula purposes, they become local revenue once they're in the hands of school districts. And as Dave mentioned, 95.5% of the formula amount goes to school districts and 4.5% to ESDs. So what are the components of local revenue, of the different sources? For the state, it's essentially the state school fund. Local revenue is dominated by property taxes. You also have common school fund, federal forest fees, the county school fund, which is quite a small amount, and then these other small sources of revenue that go into the local pot for formula purposes. So you see, now we're down to, we've gone from 3 sources, local, state, federal, down to 2, because as I said, the revenue that originates with the federal government that actually flows through our formula is labeled local revenue once it gets to the formula. So state funds about 62%, local funds about 38%. Over the past 10 or so years, the local share has started to creep back up. Prior to Measure 5, it was about 66% local, 33% state. When Measure 5 was fully phased in, that flipped, and now the local share has started to creep back up as, in the recession, state revenue has sort of stagnated. So here's a history of formula revenue. You can see looks very similar to the total operating revenue graph I showed earlier. Local revenue after the phase-in of Measure 5 has grown steadily. State revenue been a bit volatile. So all of that revenue, state and local, essentially goes into one pot and then gets distributed out on a per-weighted student basis to districts and ESDs. ESDs, their weighted students are the aggregate of the weighted students of the districts that they serve. So here's a graph that shows the equalization properties of the formula. The blue bars, and these are all the school districts in the state lined up. The blue bar is local revenue, and the red bar is state revenue. And you can see that when you combine them, they're all roughly the same amount per student. And those districts with very small local revenue get a large amount of state revenue, and vice versa. And you'll see out at the far right end, we have a handful of districts that have so much local revenue that they don't qualify for any state revenue.
What districts are those?
Those are essentially timber-rich and property-rich districts that have small numbers of students. So we've got Neocony and Seaside at the coast that have a lot of second homes and commercial property relative to the size of their student population. So they have a lot of property tax revenue. Nestucca Valley gets a lot of state timber money.
Timber money from their timber property taxes.
Yes. And from state, from the harvest, the sharing of revenue from this harvest of timber on state-owned land.
From the Tillamook Forest primarily.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. And the high, the places where we see little skyscrapers up there. Are
yeah, this. That's a result of the one piece of the formula that departs from a strict weighted student distribution, and that's the adjustment made for teacher experience. Districts with whose average teacher experience is above the state average get $25 more per weighted student for each year they're above the average, and districts with below average get $25 per year less.
I don't know if this is if that's why, but Oregon has a much higher than average percentage of teachers with master's degrees than most states. Is it part of that?
Senator Haas, I don't believe that is a result of this provision. Right. It's really a result of law regarding teacher qualifications in Oregon. What we do find, though, is you see the ones that are well above the others that stick up pretty high. Those typically are really small districts that have very few teachers, and if they've been there a long time, they can have an average experience of 25 years, whereas the state average right now is about 13. Similarly, once those high experience ones retire and they hire a couple of or three or four brand new teachers, their average experience will go down to 2 or 3 years, and they'll fall down well below everybody else. So it can be real volatile in very small districts.
Senator Berkshire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's kind of seems counterproductive to me. So if you have a school district that's trying to save money, so they're encouraging their senior teachers, their higher paid teachers to retire and bring in newer teachers at a lower pay, especially with PERS, so you're getting rid of it kind of seems counterproductive then with that formula. So they're trying to save money here, but they're actually losing money because they're getting rid of the experienced teachers. So.
Quality.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it just seems like it, yeah.
So a little bit about how we define weighted students. In law, we give weights to students, or we give weights to school districts, but they're based on student characteristics. So every student gets a weight of one, and then we add on additional weights, mostly for characteristics of the students, but occasionally for characteristics of school districts. Kindergarten students right now, because state law requires half-day kindergarten only, they are funded at 0.5. That will change next year when the new full-day kindergarten laws go into effect. Special education students get an extra full weight. English as a second language students or limited English proficient students served by English as a second language programs get an extra half weight. Pregnant and parenting an extra full weight, poverty an extra quarter weight, and so forth. The one at the bottom is one that's not based on student characteristics. We call it the small school correction. It gives additional weighted students to districts that have very small schools. And in some cases, that can be a very dramatic increase in the total number of weighted students that a district has. Sometimes more than doubling,
Mr. Chair,
their funding.
Senator Edwards.
So, Brian, for clarification, that's in addition to the small school grants, right? It wasn't their small school grants on a previous slide.
Right. Senator Haas, Senator Edwards, we've got essentially two programs. One that we call the small high school grants.
Oh yeah, small high school grant. Yeah,
that's which go to high schools in small districts, and they're made on a they're a dollar amount per ADM, per actual student. And then we have this separate program called Small High School Correction. We have a elementary version of it and a high school version of it. And it looks at the size of the small schools and then gives them, instead of giving them dollars, it gives them extra weighted students, which in turn gives them extra dollars in the formula.
Okay, and then, so a follow-up. So then, so is it the small high school, is it the previously described small high school grant program, or is it this, the small school correction that is the subject to political negotiation at the end of the last couple of legislative sessions? And I'm just wondering which program that is.
I believe that one is the small school correction. Okay. This is where the big money is.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Edwards, I get involved in those for the last couple of sessions for whatever reason. There's a real equity issue there, balanced by the difficulties in those small schools.
Right.
It gets very hard. Which one is the one where the dormitories come into play, the foreign exchange and the dormitories?
Chair Haas, I'm not sure that this program has a lot to do with that. That has to do with which students qualify to be funded through Oregon law. In many cases, they are students from other states or other countries. This program is strictly about the size of schools.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we calculate weighted students, or what we call ADMW, average daily membership weighted, which is the sum of ADM before the weights and the additional weights. And then what we actually fund districts on, we calculate their ADMW in the current year and the prior year, and they get the higher of those two. And the logic behind that is that when a district is losing enrollment over time, that their costs don't fall quite as fast as their enrollment does, so we fund them on the higher number of students they had in the prior year. Right now, we've got about 534,000 actual students in the state, if you count kindergartners as a half. We have about 570,000 if you count them as a whole. But in the formula, they count as a half right now. When you add the weights, we have about 656,000 students, weighted students. And then if you look at the higher of current year and prior year, district by district, and add those up, we have about 660 weighted students that we actually fund, what we call extended ADMW. And then the formula itself is strikingly simple once you define what a weighted student is and you know how much money you have. You take the extended ADMW of each district, you multiply it by this $4,500 target, which is actually specified in the law and has not been changed since the law was initially passed in 1991. You add in that teacher experience adjustment that I mentioned, and you know, for a district that has 1 year higher experience than the state average, that will be $25. So that middle portion in brackets, instead of $4,500, would be $4,525. And then you do that multiplication of ADMW times the part in brackets for every district, and you add it up. And because that 4,500 is much lower than we currently fund our districts, we're currently closer to $7,000. You need to multiply it by this ratio so that you spend all the money. So, you know, if we had $4.5 billion going through the formula in a given year, and the first two terms of that formula added up to $4 billion, then that ratio needs to be higher than one. Gives every district a little bit more money to make sure we distribute all the money that we have to give out. And to show you the effect of that, I, I've just shown you a history of these balance ratios, not the entire history, but you can see that it tends to grow over time as we increase funding for schools. Some of the exceptions in 2002-03, that first year there, that was the recession in the early part of the 2000s, so that had fallen from a ratio that was above one in prior years. And then it grows over time until we hit 2008-09, and then it falls again as we get into this recession that we just came out of recently.
Gentlemen, we're going to get kicked out of here in a few minutes. So.
Okay, let me finish up here. Most of these things Dave talked about a little bit. Transportation grants, we reimburse districts for their actual transportation costs, anywhere from 70% of their spending to 90% of their spending. The higher spending districts, which tend to be the small rural ones, are at the 90%. The cost drivers in education, students in poverty, we've seen that grown, particularly in this latest recession, more and more students identified as being in poverty. Special ed students have been growing faster than the general student population, as have English language learners. Employee salaries are about 51% of all spending, operating spending by school districts, and benefits 28%. That 28 is substantially higher than most other states because our retirement, our PERS rate is dramatically higher than most states are facing right now.
Senator Butcher.
So payroll, basically 79% of their budget, did I just do the math quick?
Chair has, Senator Bertrager, that's correct.
Boy, almost 80%.
Labor intensive.
Human resources. Yeah, okay.
All the more reason when we get teachers, quality is important. We want a good teacher. Mentored.
Yeah,
80%. Qualified experience.
A short history, I guess not so short anymore, of the cost drivers. Total enrollment up annual average of about 0.7% since 1991. Special ed students up three times that much. Limited English proficient, 8.4% a year. That's just dramatic growth. I will say, though, that in the last 3 or 4 years, that has flattened out. So they're not growing nearly as quickly as they did in the past. Students in poverty, about twice as fast as the general student population. Teacher salaries up about 2.4% a year. That's a bit above inflation over that period, but not much. PERS rate doubled since that time and is even higher now. This is a couple years old.
That's a really interesting chart.
Mm-hmm. And then health insurance, 4.7% a year on average, but that too has declined fairly dramatically in the past 4 or 5 years, partly because of limits that school districts have put on how much they're willing to pay, passing on the increases above that to employees. But also we've seen in the last couple years a real slowdown in the actual cost of providing health care.
Right.
Some national comparisons. In 1991, Oregon was 15th highest in funding per pupil. In 11-12, last year that we've got national data right now, we had fallen to 33rd. Over that period, we had the second lowest growth overall in the country in how much our funding for our per pupil funding had increased. So
perhaps we could end on that cheerful note.
Yes.
Thank you.
So last one, inflation-adjusted spending per student decline over that period. And if you do it per weighted student, the decline is about 25%. So I'll end it right there.
Thank you both. Committee, we'll have some formula bills before us, one that gets to that ELL chart with 587% increase. So maybe there's something there. Maybe there's some consensus. Thank you both. No further business before us. We are adjourned.
Did you use the word?
Forrest, we are adjourned.
Did you use the word?